Welcome to Art House Legends Podcast, where high art and geek culture collide. I'm the movie dude, Eric, your host that brings the guns for show and the knives for pros.
And I'm Chris Tondeville.
I'm Christian Lee. I am the internet's dad.
In this episode, we're discussing Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, starring Jason Fleming, Jason Statham, Dexter Fletcher, Vinnie Jones, Nick Moran, and Sting, directed by Guy Ritchie. All right, so I'll be honest here. Whenever I'm thinking about doing a Guy Ritchie movie, I know that maybe this should be the first one I'm thinking about, but I always thought I would start off with either Snatch or maybe one of the Sherlock Holmes movies. I feel like that's the place I would have gone if I were the one suggesting Guy Ritchie. But Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. I gotta ask, what is your familiarity with Guy Ritchie's work, and specifically towards this movie? And let's start off with our guest, Christian.
Well, I'm kind of immersed in all British film and TV culture. Like, I fake my IP address so that the BBC thinks I live in London.
Nice.
So, I mean, don't call the tax man on me. You know, they have to pay taxes for their channel. So, I spoof my IP address. I love their chat shows. I can't watch our own anymore after watching theirs. And I love Guy Ritchie. And when you told me, hey, we're going to do this movie, you can talk as much crap about this movie as you want. And I'm like, I remember that to be a pretty good movie, actually. And then, of course, I'm watching it again with fresh eyes. I had not seen it but the one time when it first came out. And I've definitely got some thoughts on it. I mean, I still love the movie. Right, but I'm familiar with his work, yeah.
Well, before I get to Krish, I have to ask, are you keeping up with EastEnders?
Now, see, that I don't do soap operas. I do host a rom-com podcast, so I talk about soap operas. And in the last episode, I think, I admitted that when I was in high school, I had gotten hooked on them in the summertime with my aunt. And the first year of junior high, I had after school gym. I would go home every day to watch soap operas, and I flunked gym because I was going home to see my stories. So I'm still trying to get my man card back. And then I started a rom-com podcast. So it's a flawed plan.
Yes, toxic masculinity will definitely have your balls for that one.
I mean, it's a thing.
It is a thing. All right, Chris, what about you?
Yeah, I'm pretty familiar with the gangster British movies. I've seen pretty much all of Guy Ritchie, Green Street Hooligans. I don't know. What are the other ones?
Dude,
the one where Tom Hardy's in prison as that famous prisoner.
Oh, yes.
It keeps breaking out. I know it's not multiple hooligan, but he was the ultimate hooligan.
Bronson.
And that's a must-see because it's just a look at one guy, and he's so self-destructive and destructive. It's the best. It's if you took the funny parts out of all these guys, put them into one guy that was jacked.
Yeah.
That's Bronson.
Yeah. And then... speaking of Tom Hardy, there was the other one where he's the two brothers. I've seen that, and
Legend.
That's fantastic. Yeah, Legend was really good.
Not to be mistaken by that Tom Cruise movie.
Right, not that one.
All right, well, but, you know, when you brought up Bronson, I completely forgot about it, and I do want to just say one thing about Bronson right quick. When I first saw Bronson, I was on my couch half asleep, and Tom Hardy scared me.
Yeah.
I wasn't expecting him to basically like get up in my face from my couch, but for there was a moment when he's like staring right at the screen, like screaming at it. It scared me. So <Yeah. laughs> that was my introduction to Tom Hardy proper. But yes. All right. So I got to say this right here. British gangster movies, and I'm actually kind of tying this in with British gangsters and British hooligan movies, because those are two different genres of sorts. I mean, they both deal with crime, but they're looking at it from very different places. British gangster movies is usually something organized, and there's a bit of refinement to it. There's something classy about British gangsters. Whereas British hooligans is dirty, grimy, grungy. Everyone just saying "fuck the world" right at everyone's other faces,
right.
And just really getting in each other's grills. And so the thing that I have to kind of take away from what Guy Ritchie does, because he mixes these two genres, it's like he wants the cool of gangster movies, but he wants to pepper it in with that kind of punk rock aspect that you kind of see with the hooligan movies. And it's very interesting balance that he does with his movies, not specifically just with this movie, but like even with Snatch. And I'm going to tip my hand here. My favorite of Guy Ritchie's movies, I don't want to say The Gentleman just yet because I want to give it some time to really let it savor. But the one that I always go to is Rock and Rolla. Rock and Rolla is my favorite of his movies. And I know that confuses people. Everyone wants to go to Snatch, and Snatch is okay, but I felt like it was trying to go for something and it just slightly didn't get to it. But Rock and Rolla, in my opinion, is a refined Guy Ritchie. It's Guy Ritchie who has kind of found that mix that I think he's been playing at with his other movies. But I'll be honest here, when it comes to Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, I had never seen this movie until this podcast.
Wow.
This slipped my radar. When it came out, it came out in 99, and that was my senior year, and it was all about The Matrix. That was the movie that really stuck out at me at the same time that Lock, Stock came out. And then, of course, Star Wars was what everyone was really eager for. And so those were the movies that I was paying attention to. And then, of course, you get into late 99 and like you just had nothing but good movies coming out. So Lock, Stock just kind of got buried in that lead. But I completely missed out on this one. And by the time that by the time Snatch came out, I was not as impressed as other people were, so I never got to the point where I really wanted to see it. So this was my first chance to see Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels for this podcast. And I gotta say something. I mean, because I'm thinking about this as a film fanatic, as someone who is a partial film historian, part film fangirl. As anyone who listened to last week's episode knows, I do that quite often. But this movie came out at the very tail end of what I think is formerly known as the 90s British explosion, right? Because this was the time that we started to see movies from like Danny Boyle and John Madden, and you know, these British filmmakers were coming thanks to Miramax and thanks to the booming independent scene, were coming over to the United States and were making just making a big splash here in the United States. Out of curiosity, what is your familiarity with the British explosion? Stuff like Trainspotting, Shakespeare in Love. The Beach would come out 1 year later, which would be kind of Britain taking over Hollywood for a moment before Harry Potter, of course.
I've seen all of those films, but I think the Miramax point you made is really good. And to look at it earlier, when you're looking at hooligans versus gangsters, hooligans was definitely the train spotting thing, and that sprouted off. And then this is definitely the gangster thing, and people started aping Guy Ritchie, and people started aping Boyle. You know, you could see where it led off from those two. But I hadn't watched this since it first came out. And as soon as the movie opens up, and I immediately was like, oh, is this Clerks UK? Like, I had totally forgotten. You can thank Kevin Smith for some of this movie. I mean, I was watching it, and it has to do with Guy Ritchie always injecting humor, the way it was shot. I mean, if you had put this movie in black and white, I would have gone, oh, Kev faked being a British guy, and he went over there. And this is Clerks UK. I mean, totally. Mm-hmm. And even when they get into, I know we'll get to it later, but when they start talking Cockney and translating on screen, I mean, that's a Kevin Smith joke. I mean, that might as well be there. So now I remember why I love this movie. I was like, oh, I love British movies. I love Kev, and I'm a fangirl for that. So, I mean, I'll get my signed Kevin Smith character. So I'm a fangirl. And I was like, oh, okay. I remember why I like this movie so much. Yeah, it's a fun movie, man.
So what about you, Chris?
So, I mean, I've seen Trainspotting and the other ones. For me, I mean, Lockstock. So I saw Snatch first, and then I have a tendency to go back into a filmmaker's career or go back even to an actor's career that I just like really resonated with. Mm-hmm. And Snatch had me from the get-go as far as the music, the style, everything. So when I go back and I was looking at Lockstock, I watch that movie every couple years because I love it. Like, I'm pretty sure that I just saw it like 6 or 7 months ago. So for me to hear that you guys, for Eric, 20 years since it's been released, never seen it, is just ridiculous to me. And especially for like being any kind of movie guy, like this is where like so much kicked off. You have Matthew Vaughn producing, and then you also have his style coming through later on in some of his movies. Like it's, I don't know. I think it's such a like a groundbreaking work, and for Guy Ritchie to write, direct, and then work on like such a small budget. Like to your point, Christian, the small budget, the Kevin Smith feel to it.
Oh yeah,
works all the way through. I love it.
Yeah, yeah. It definitely feels like an indie gangster movie, and I mean, you have me at the beginning. You know, they had shaky cam at the beginning. And I'm sure it was done on purpose. It was definitely a style. And like you said, by the time it gets to Rock and Rolla, he's just like perfected his style at that point. It's polished. Yeah. It's finished.
I don't know about Rock and Rolla. That's silly.
I know a lot of people don't love it. I'm just saying he's right about that was like him polishing everything and going, this is this version of the movie that I make now. And that's the final version of it. And I think now he started making other movies, you know, with other brands, but that's definitely his polished gangster movie.
Yeah, I thought Eric was going to say Aladdin was his favorite for a second.
Fuck you. Fuck you. Okay. But seriously,
are we supposed to hate that movie?
No.
Because I got four kids and it was not bad. It was not a bad movie. And I was around for the original.
Right.
It's not bad.
It's not bad, but let's be honest here.
And I have a daughter, so I have to go female empowerment.
After watching The Gentlemen, it just feels like it was a waste of Guy Ritchie's time. I mean, I have you seen The Gentlemen yet? I got to ask.
Yeah.
That one, I kept putting off going to see it in the theater, and I was like, oh, got to get that one. I still haven't seen it.
I'm just going to say this. When you see The Gentlemen, and you realize that when he was making Aladdin, he had this tucked away, working on that, kind of perfecting it, that this is the movie that I was hoping to see from Guy Ritchie since Rock and Rolla. I, you know, don't get me wrong, I have an appreciation for the Sherlock Holmes movie, specifically two. First one was, but the second one, real much better. But, you know, the King Arthur movie, in Aladdin, it feels like watching him kind of come back to what he's done. Just, I'm sorry. I don't want to get too excited because I've only seen it the once in theaters, but it left such a big impression on me. I even went out on Facebook and immediately said it was the first great movie of the 20s. And that's in January. Like
You've heard of things called paychecks, though, right?
Yes.
You've heard like some directors or some actors even, you know, like, I make two for them and one for me.
Right.
And if I'm rich enough, I can make one for them and one for me. And I think that's the place he's at now, where he's like, okay, I'll make this one for you, but you got to make, you know. So, I mean, they help finance their own movies that way.
Is he still paying alimony to Madonna? I'm curious.
How can that ever stop? I mean, she needs tubs to sing in on TikTok. There's lots of things that woman needs. Facelifts. I mean, she's on 39. Well, so
she is a material girl. I mean,
she's literally made of material. Yes.
Okay. All right. So, you know, when we talk about Guy Ritchie, you know, we talk about Kevin Smith, but honestly, though, whenever people talk about Guy Ritchie, they're more talking or comparing him to the likes of Quentin Tarantino. That seems to be the one that people go to most frequently. Do you see that comparison by any chance, or do you think that's an unfair one?
I definitely get it, and I think it's because of Pulp. But I mean, me personally, if I'm looking at a Quentin movie and a Kevin Smith movie, I think it looked more like the other one. But I mean, I can see that, the quick cuts with comparison and Pulp. But I think if Pulp wasn't made, people wouldn't compare them as much.
Well, yeah,
I feel like Lock, Stock was made on the budget of Clerks.
Right.
It's
and he wanted Pulp.
Yeah. Well, here's how interesting it is. So I saw Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels on DVD on my I'll be honest, it's a 62-inch UHD screen. And when I put it in and I started playing it, I thought to myself, oh, wow, the disc must have gotten bad, or it must have been damaged in some fashion or form.
That's the movie.
And so, I was expecting it to look a lot more polished. And I went on, I went online and looked for, kind of to just see, like, what should it look like? And no, it was, I mean, with the exception of it being, you know, too big for a DVD screen, to be honest, no, it was that bad. and nothing against the movie, because again, you can tell that this movie is on a very low budget. Like, this isn't, you know, this is not, you know, $10-20 million budget. We're probably looking at what, maybe 2-5. If it's more than 5 million, I would be very impressed.
It was below £1 million, or yeah,
which is,
it was about 800,000 or something like that. Yeah,
1.5 here. But Jason Statham's salary now would be 3 times the budget of that movie. Well, so I mean, he's
only getting people before $3 million? They were.
He got people before that. I mean, if he was giving them a deal.
Yeah, you know, right. That's what I'm thinking.
He's given so many actors like a bump in this movie. I mean, nobody knew who Statham was. I mean, it was funny to see Statham like not know how to fight. But
right.
Like, wait a minute. Is this the same guy?
Well, Statham was a model before this.
Oh, yeah.
Within 2 years, he became an international figure. Within 2 years of this movie. He blew up. I mean, between, I know that, you know, people joke about the one with him and Jet Li, but you know, with between that and Snatch, he became an international figure right off those two movies, and those came out within 2 years of Lock, Stock,
which is funny because he literally says, knock him out. What do you mean, knock him out? How do I knock a guy out? And it's like, oh my gosh.
It hurts me. Right. It hurts me so much because Jason Statham is funny.
Oh, like, if you
look at especially Snatch and Lock, Stock, like, this is the one that I wanted to see. And then now all he is a violent bruiser pretty much throughout the rest of his career. And you have all the Fast and Furious, you have all the Transporters, you have him just doing kicks and shit in the air and then splits and all this nonsense and just like, go back. Like, mm-hmm. I want to see you in a trench coat just talking about sausages for a minute.
What do you think about this Tarantino connection? Do you see there being one, or do you think it's out of proportion?
Kind of. I can see like what Christian was talking about with Pulp Fiction. I think that is kind of spot on. I mean, his dialogue is pretty good. Obviously, his use of curse words is pretty good. And then with some of the violence in there, I'll take a little bit, so that's fine. But overall, I think the Kevin Smith one is a better comparison, mostly because of the quick dialogue, the different dialects, and the different accents in there. And just the completely different characters. I think that because everything is so outrageous and kind of accented in a different way, and everything is kind of pushed to the extreme as far as these characters go, I think that's a way better comparison is Kevin Smith rather than Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah. All right, so I'm actually going to say that there's actually a person that I would say is even better compared to Guy Ritchie for this particular film. In some instances, maybe his other gangster movies to an extent, but out of curiosity, I have to ask, have either of you heard of Elmer Leonard?
Oh, yeah.
No.
Justified, right?
Justified, Get Shorty, yeah.
Oh, okay, Get Shorty.
Yeah, Elmer Leonard is, for anyone who doesn't know who Elmer Leonard is, Elmer Leonard is a novelist who, he was a screenwriter at the beginning of his career. Then he decided to write books, crime books, but he has this extremely flashy dialogue that he has for all of his characters. So his characters have these really flamboyant, very Hollywood-esque type personalities. So, you know, just the year before Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, we had Out of Sight, which had George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez. That was also Elmer Leonard. To the point where Get Shorty, which is a great movie. I hope at some point I would love to do it. But you could literally, the script was literally word for word from the book. All the words that you hear in the movie are the exact dialogue that's in the book itself. That's how good his dialogue is when it comes to kind of films, how you can translate it into a film. And as I was watching Lock, Stock, and again, I'm kind of going back to The Gentleman because I'd seen it so recently. I could definitely sense the rhythms and the patterns that reminded me a lot about Elmer Leonard's writings and how his dialogue crafts and how he plays on character relationships the way that this film does, and especially with the especially because Elmer Leonard is fascinated by stupid criminals. He loves stupid criminals, and let's be honest here, all the criminals in this movie are pretty fucking stupid.
Yeah. But like Elmore Leonard, he likes stupid criminals getting one over at the end.
Yes.
Like this, you know, I mean, does he like stupid criminals or does he like stupid criminals and even dumber cops? But yeah, I get your point.
Well, what I mean by he loves, it's like those are his favorite characters to follow. And the thing is that because I, especially when we're always watching movies about smart crooks and smart cops, it's just fascinating to watch something very real. Like whenever you hear about an actual crime, you're not hearing about a mastermind. You're hearing about how some dumbass decides that he's going to leave his getaway car on the street and he gets towed by the time that he gets back to it. I mean, that's the stuff that you hear about. And so him taking what are basically these four different stories, these four different criminals of sorts, and he finds ways of making them connect with one another and collide with one another. And even though I had never seen this movie before, by the time we got to the ending, I knew exactly where it was going to go. And normally that would be something that I would be against. You know, if something's too predictable, then you've lost it, right? It's like, you know, the magic is lost somehow. But the thing is that if you can craft it well enough, if you can make it so it's inevitable, it has to end this way, then that's where a movie that maybe is predictable at the end still is something that you can enjoy.
Well, you might know where it's going, but you want to see like how it gets there. Like that's fine. I'm fine seeing a movie. I know exactly where they're going to end up, but I'm like, what turns is he going to trick me in? And there's a couple twists in this movie that they're great. There's a couple things where you would have gone, oh, I thought this would have happened and they would have run each other there, but no, it happened to them a different way. And this group attacked, you know, so I like that. And I think the reason they like stupid criminals is, to a stupid criminal, everything in the world is a possibility.
That's true.
Everything's a possibility. So when they look at the potential windfall from a crime, or they look at like the big money bag with the dollar sign on it, they're like, I can do it. Anything's possible. I get that money. Anything's possible. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to do anything possible to get that money. And I think that's why you either have to watch a really smart mastermind like Ocean's 11, or you watch really dumb criminals like in these movies, because both of them are the same. Everybody in the Middle is boring. Mm-hmm. Those are boring movies. They are sleepers. They're all the ones we think of as dumb, the normal, regular guys trying to pull something off. But the dummies and the masterminds, oh, man, tasty.
You know what? I love it. I love exactly everything you said about that, and I agree. But, okay, so let's talk about the movie specifically, because I have to admit, I was curious to see where this goes, because we have a whole bunch of characters. In fact, for an independent movie, this thing's got a huge cast.
Yeah.
I mean, for a million-dollar movie, we're talking about important characters. We're talking about, what, 15, 20? Something like that? Everyone's got a name. Everyone's got a nickname. Everyone's got a backstory that the movie moves really quickly in order to get through them all.
Yeah, it does a great job with that, too. I also love that every mob movie, no matter if it's in England or America or even in Japan, there's a guy called Nick the Greek. Like there's a Yakuza gangster right now named Nick the Greek, and he's Japanese. He's totally Japanese.
Right.
I mean, he's like really Japanese, and he's like, Nick the Greek. Like, okay, cool. I buy it. It's a gangster movie, man. No, yeah. I love how they zipped in everybody's story. They just, you know, a little bit of narration, a little bit of explaining, and it's like, boom. And you see these guys, and you're like, oh, yeah, I believe it.
Yeah. Yeah, they do such a good job with the backstory real quick, and then the characterization real quick, and then the style and the costumes, because then you're looking at, okay, this is the epitome. This is Barry the Baptist. This is the guy, the pot. Not the four dumb white guys. The
guy with the afro.
Yeah, I can't remember his
can't remember his character name. I didn't.
Brawler.
Yeah.
No. Yeah.
Something like that. Breaker.
Yeah. Breaker.
Breaker. Yeah, Rory Breaker. I think. But yeah, he's perfect because then you see kind of like that quick backstory of him basically lighting someone on fire, and then you're just like, oh yeah, that's the dude right there.
Well, that's the best callback in the movie. Taking the fire extinguisher out of the building first.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, that's what lets you know he's crazy. Like the one thing is just anger, but when you take the fire extinguisher out first, you're crazy.
Well, and I had forgotten that. I love the fact that we meet Rory before we get his backstory. You know, when
in the bar.
Yeah, because Statham asks if he'll turn down the TV, and he says no. And so we already kind of know there's something interesting about this guy already, and then to have it told to us later, you know, what this guy is. I thought that was a really good way of kind of having the stories collide before the fireworks. You know, to let us know, yes, these stories are going to come together, but it's going to come together on our schedule whenever we're ready for it to happen. And I like that. I like that it signals to us that these things are, they're going to feel like they're worlds apart, but they're really close together. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. And I hadn't seen the movie since I originally saw it, like I said, and when the guy ran out of the bar on fire, I'm like, I love that there's just a random guy running out of the bar on fire. And then, of course, it comes back to he had asked him to turn down the TV right after he burnt somebody for the same thing. And I was like, oh, yeah, I didn't remember that. It's such a gem of a scene. It's one of the best movie callbacks I've ever watched. I mean, it's just so great because it catches you so off guard. The four of them just looking at, or the three of them looking at a guy on fire and being like, yeah, it's London, and just walking into the pub. Like, all right. Yeah, stabbing, burning, whatever.
As you do.
No one helps him. Yeah, no one helps him.
Why would you? He's on fire. He obviously did something wrong. He's leaving a pub, not drunk, so it's his fault.
Well, I think the fire will sober you up pretty quick.
Yeah.
Good thing.
I mean, don't get me wrong. There's probably a Scott out there that that would be on fire and still be asking for another pint. But just, you know, in most cases, yes, catching fire would definitely have a sobering aspect to it. But yeah, I really enjoy how it sets up the card game. I enjoy how it sets up the different figures, the four friends, how they're not really even hustlers. They're just kind of, you know, stupid young men, you know, in Britain that have this aspiration of getting their, you know, having their card shark friend kind of get into this poker game, which we find out is rigged from the beginning. And I didn't realize how important it is for me to be able to sympathize with these four guys without knowing that the game was rigged, right? Because if you didn't have that information, you kind of feel like they have it coming to an extent, yeah. Right?
Well, but, I mean, they've been surrounded by gangsters. Sting is a gangster. I mean, There's something Sting did. He's got a bar in London that's completely paid for.
You think he's also a John Wick figure?
Well, I mean, he tells the gangster, the local gangster, to F off. He tells it right to Vinnie Jones' face, like, go tell him to F off. I'm choosing my words carefully. Yeah. F off.
No. I mean, he's willing to sacrifice his podcast. Feel free.
That's fine. So he's willing to sacrifice his son. He doesn't give a crap. Like, he is. So these kids have been raised by rough guys. You know, they've been in it this whole time, and they're just young kids who are like, oh, we're going to game the system. And these guys are like, we've been doing this for 100 years. You're not gaming us. And then they get gamed. It's so great. And just to see him sweat it out when he offers them a loan in that game, every part of his being knew not to take that loan.
Right.
And yet he still let him walk him into it, because he basically goes, no, I'm not going to let you not take the loan. It's like, all right, well, what am I supposed to do here?
Well, technically,
wanted the bar. Well, here's the thing, though. You have to realize they just wanted the bar. They set up the whole game just because they wanted Sting's bar. Yeah. They didn't care about the kids or the money. They were playing a long game on Sting, which is why I'm saying Sting has done some stuff in the past, or his character. We're going to call him Sting. He's Sting. But he's obviously done some stuff to, you know, say screw off to these guys in the past, because the whole reason they're doing it is because they even mentioned at the beginning, they want that kid's dad's bar. And so that kid doesn't even realize he's just like a chip in this game.
And I really appreciate that, because again, I like how we're introduced to the four guys. I like how they all have their own unique personalities, but at the same time, you can understand why they're friends. You could feel that these would be guys that would get together and enjoy each other's company. I especially like Soap. I'll be honest here. I think Soap is, you know, I like his backstory. I like the fact that he's the one who's constantly kind of reeling in the guys' wilder aspirations, kind of being the one, the sense of reason. I especially love how his idea about the gun and the knife. You know, the gun is flashy, but it makes too much noise. You have the knife; it's quick, quiet, and you can get the job done. I really like the fact that all four of these guys play a very important part to getting to their plan, and that they all have a part to play in it.
Or anybody that listens that likes Soap, just sidebar, he's in a great British show that was there for like three seasons called Hotel Babylon.
Yes,
where he plays like the wise doorman that can get you anything you need anytime. And that's where I was introduced to him. I mean, I'd seen him in this, obviously, but that's where I really got to know him. And he's great. And he's been in everything. People don't even realize, but he's background character sometimes. It just gets a couple lines, but he's perfect in everything he does. You're right. That speech about the gun and the knife was great, man.
Dexter Fletcher is actually a filmmaker that I'm now paying attention to. He plays Soap, and yeah, he's been a character actor forever. I'll talk about it in Geek Sheet, because I'm following this guy for different reasons than you, but
right.
We got a lot of movie to still unpack too.
We do. So we'll get into it. All right. So the card. Okay, I'm going to say the card game is where we really see the first bit of Guy Ritchie filmmaking. Right. This is we start to really see his style or the beginning of his style at this card game. I love how specifically how he holds the camera centered on the actor, even as the actor is like bobbing and weaving, so that it feels like the background is what's moving and not the actor. I love how he really stylizes that poker game and kind of uses the fast forward, rewind, slow down, that kind of the having actors look right into the camera as they're flipping cards and spinning the chips, like, you know, stuff that would not really happen in a organized mob card game. I seriously doubt that Harry the Hatchet would be interested in people flipping cards around. You know, that's time that he could be using to take their money from them.
That's true.
But it does look cool, though, right?
Yeah, it looks cool. And he does. So in my podcast, shameless plug for Dad Does Rom-Coms, we always point out movie tropes because we do we have a shot game. So you can do a shot every time there's a classic movie trope. And he definitely does a couple of those, like, right, boom, boom, boom. Like the big buy-in, that's a classic movie trope. And the throwing the things at the screen, like the fingers coming at you, throwing the cards at the camera. I mean, that's his style, but it was almost like he's like, hey, let's make this a 3D movie. I don't know, it's possible.
Right.
Just whoosh, whoosh. And you're sitting there ducking like bullets, you know, these cards and stuff being thrown at you. And it was pretty great. And, you know, he's like, can we throw a montage in there too? Somebody one day is going to have a drinking game for this and I want them drunk. Yes. So I thought that was pretty cool.
I'm going to say this when it comes to Guy Ritchie. Guy Ritchie knows how to do a montage. He did
2.5 of them. So yeah, I wrote them all down. He does know how to do a montage. He could just make a movie montage. He could be a music video director because that's what those montages are. They're music videos.
Okay, out of curiosity, I don't want to go too far off, but have y'all ever heard of the Drive series? It was these short films made by different filmmakers in 2000. That was it was an advertisement for BMW. Every film, like we're talking about, like Ridley Scott did one, like Alfonso Cuarón.
Clive Owen
was the driver, and he took these BMWs and he did all this crazy shit with. Well, Guy Ritchie got to direct one with his wife Madonna. Madonna played Madonna, and basically she's this, you know, she's a bitch, and the driver has to get her to a gig, but she acts really bad to him, but she doesn't buckle her seatbelt. So he takes her on a wild ride through London set to Woohoo. Nice. Oh, I don't know the actual name of the song, but Woohoo.
Oh, Song 2 by Blur.
Blur, yes. Yeah.
And it is the best music video you could ever have for that song. It is so much fun. And the end joke at the end of that is perfect. But yeah, it's on YouTube. Watch it. Just watch
it. It's called Guy Ritchie's Overboard.
Are you talking about Swept Away? That's
no Overboard, the classic movie where the mean rich woman is a jerk the whole time and then falls off the boat and falls in love with the guy. That's Guy Ritchie's Overboard. Yeah. Well, on speed.
Technically speaking, he made a movie called Swept Away that was the exact same thing.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
But yes, it was Overboard. and yes, the I'm not going to spoil the end. The ending is hilarious. But that said, so when he loses the bet, he loses. And I love how, you know, when he's leaving the ring, because it's in a boxing ring, of course. But, you know, I love how when he's getting through the ropes and stuff, and the camera is staying on his face the entire time. So
yeah, it's chest camera.
Yeah, I love how that looks, and he uses that very often. I mean, he pretty much uses that for every one of his films up until Rock and Roll, if I'm not correct. Maybe did he use it in Sherlock Holmes? I can't remember, but I know that's one of his go-tos.
I forgot that he made that movie. So there you go.
Yeah, a lot of people did, but I love that. I love how I love how that's framed. I love how that's shot. I love because if you've ever lost $500,000 before, I'm pretty sure you would feel the exact same way that he does.
I feel that way when I lose $5. I have four kids. It all matters.
Well, I think between the filming and the editing, they do a really, really good job of portraying the feeling in every scene. So you have that one that you're talking about, Eric, where he is screwed, to lack of a better word. You know, everything he knows is going to be owned, and then himself is going to be owned by Harry the Hatchet here shortly. His head starts swimming. Like, he has no idea what is going on. So that sense of confusion is in there. Later on, there's a great scene of all four of them celebrating in the bar, and just the way that it's shot and edited, you feel that jubilation. But when you go through the whole movie, like, it's shot in particular way for you to feel every little thing, where if it's Vinny's or Big Chris's anger towards someone and him just slamming their head in a door for a while, you know, the way that it's shot, I think, is makes the feeling that much more intense.
I definitely get that. Guy Ritchie does that very, very well, especially like after he throws up outside of the ring, when he gets caught by the Baptist. Gotta admit, I love these names, to be honest. You know, and he's told that not only is he responsible for getting this money, but because they know that he got because he was bankrolled by his friends. Now his friends are also in for this. And that is like, that is some bullshit, right? I mean, I'll be honest here. Like the fact that these guys, that his friends didn't just dunk him into the Thames, with a few hundred pounds of rocks on him, says a whole lot about their friendship, to be honest. Because, like, well, even for, like, Soap, who was like, I don't really want in on this. You know, he was basically coerced by Statham, right? You know, Statham kind of had to loosen him up to get the money from him.
Yeah, but I think they're in for a penny, in for a pound kind of thing. Because they're all childhood friends. They've grown up with each other. And then they all know what they're doing as far as giving him $25,000 or 25,000 pounds, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. You know, they know what's going on. And then they also know that if he fails for whatever reason, which obviously he does, it all falls on them. So it's either like they can't sacrifice their friend because they know that they're going to get got too, because it's not going to just end with Eddie. It's going to go for all four of them, and they're either going to put up a little bit of a fight or a scheme or whatever, which they end up doing, or they're all going to go in a trash can.
Yeah,
exactly. And the dad will still end up losing the bar, because those gangsters were going to get it one way or the other. They were just like, if we have to kill those four kids along the way, we really don't care. Yeah. That's what we want.
Yeah. Sting is in this movie is such a, like a weird little oddity. I think that you're right. He's got to be something, right?
Yeah,
he's got to be just like a badass or whatever. But seeing him, like, I grew up listening to his music and then not knowing that he acts sometimes. So when I I had no idea. This was my first time seeing him act. So, and then seeing him like pop up in this movie, and I'm like, holy shit, that's Sting. And then the air that he like gives off, he's like, yeah, I am Sting. I am the badass. I am the coolest person in this movie. So
he is. Yeah, he's so cool. And he's old. Like, people don't realize how old he is. I saw something where they went to his hometown with him, like on 60 Minutes, and all of the people his age that went to high school with him look like the Gordon's fishermen.
Right. I mean,
they have the sweaters, the yellow coats, the, you know, huge beards, and they're his age, and he's just ageless because he does tantric sex with his wife, and he's
I was about to say, like, it's all that tantric sex.
It is.
He was born in 51.
He's cool at everything, though. He can play every instrument. He can get any woman. He can probably get half the dudes. And he's just cool. He's in any scene. He's cool.
Yeah. But it was like, holy shit, this is so cool for me to see that. And then, yeah, I think that whole scenario that you were talking about really puts it in like a bigger aspect of it, because you don't think about the bar. You think about the four kids, more or less, yeah, against these gangsters, and then all the shenanigans that ensue after that. You don't think about the fact that, oh, Harry doesn't care about Eddie. Nope.
They're just pawns.
Yeah.
But yeah, Sting was born in 51, and he still looks like he's 40, and it's still just ridiculous.
Well, not anymore, but I will say this, though.
Oh, no.
But the thing is, like, if you had seen Sting as Fade, Rotha, in Dune, you'd understand this guy has the ability of coming off like a badass.
Yeah, he's got chops.
So I'm just saying, dude's got some serious skills. And the thing is that one thing I gotta appreciate here is how he plays this character, and that's why I'm absolutely agreeing with you that he's got a past, and I think Sting place him as someone with a past, because I get the sense that, yeah, if by some chance his son had been murdered by Harry, I have a strange feeling that he's going to be going down to his basement and breaking open a slab in order to get a whole bunch of guns.
Yeah.
Like
he goes Taken/Wick. Yep.
He will light up London going after Harry.
I want to see that movie.
And then still beat his son when he gets him out. Like, he'll still, like, just lash him afterwards. He's like, you made me do all this. You made me burn the city down.
Yeah.
You know, he's like the Russian gangster in the original John Wick. He's like, I'm still going to punch my son in the mouth. All right, let's save him. All
right. Right.
But I'll be honest here. Because especially considering how, you know, his first scene with his son, you know, he seems like a firm dad, but you don't really sense that this guy is too big of a menace. You know, he's not, you know, you don't really see him as a badass. It's only after he finds out. And I love how the gangsters send Big Chris to, to kind of break the news to him. Right. It's like almost like kind of like a taunt of sorts. Right. And that look on his face, not fear, pissed. Like,
right.
Like, right. For I have a strange feeling, like when it came to his to the first digit being cut off, that is when we will see Sting. You know, I feel like that would be the most, like, watching it for the second time of the podcast, I honestly got the sense that I don't think that his son was in any mortal danger. Like, I have a feeling that Harry bit off more than he could chew, that one way or the other, he was going to end his life with a whole bunch of bullets, you know, in his gut. I just got the sense that, you know, if by some chance this did not go, if by some chance they didn't find out about this drug deal or this robbery, Harry's time was going to be short on this earth.
I don't know.
Well, it would be cool.
Yeah.
Because
to see Sting go crazy on him.
Yeah. But it was just his calm. Like, he wasn't afraid for his son. He wasn't, you know, it's like, in a way, even when he, you know, even at the end of the movie, when he's telling him, you know, you better walk, you know, you're going to walk to the bar.
Yeah.
You get the sense that, you know, like, and we're talking about some tough London streets. I have a feeling that people know not to touch him. Like, you know, I have a strange feeling that he has been very sheltered as a child from the dangers of where he is.
And it comes off like that too, because if you look at his friends, you know, you have Statham, who plays basically just like a street hustler throughout the everything. Soap is the cook, right? So he's the only one with kind of a future. And then I forget the other dude's character's name, but he's seedy just like everybody else. He knows how to get Nick the Greek. He knows how to get all this stupid shit. You know, so I think that's a good point in the overall story, where there's got to be something where Eddie could actually be more or less untouchable unless he's in this like specific way. Like, maybe Harry has been planning this for a little bit, and now it's time to set everything in motion. And unfortunately, Barry the Baptist hires the worst people to do anything, and it all goes to shit for him.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so, you know, so when we get to the other parts of the movie, with this robbery and with the two guns, I had a straight, like the way that they introduced the two guns and the two dumbasses that are sent to get these guns. First off, I do love the fact that that the one guy refused to put on the mask because he just got his hair done. And permed. He wasn't going to let that.
Yeah, it was permed too. It wasn't just done. It was permed in the right. late 90s.
Right. Yes.
It's like, the worst, okay, dude. Yeah.
Is the worst white guy thing you could have done in the late 90s.
I mean, I know. I mean, it was supposed to, I guess, take place. Yeah, it was fuzzy when it actually took place. But well, yeah, that was interesting. And the other thing is, they're double-barreled shotguns, people.
Yes.
So it's lock, stock, and four smoking barrels. They're double-barreled shotguns. So the name is crap. I mean, the whole name. And to say one more thing we do on our podcast, we always have alternate titles for the movies at the end. And I wrote down that this movie should be called Unlock Gate and Four Smoking Idiots, because that's the crux of this movie.
Yeah.
And but definitely there's four barrels. No matter what you do and how you change this movie, Guy Ritchie was like, no, it sounds really good that way. And it's like, yeah, that's as inaccurate or inaccurate as you can get. Two smoking barrels.
Yeah. Okay. Because we've been talking a lot about Eddie and Sting and kind of that story and Harry, but there's this whole other part where you have Pot Farmers, and then you have Roy Breaker, the one that we talked about earlier, who owns the pot farm basically. And then you have these other idiots, these other gangsters that live right next door to Eddie that are trying to get this huge score for themselves too. And then everything just all kind of coagulates, I guess. I guess that's a good word for it.
That's the one hole in this movie, is these guys know every gangster in town. I mean, they live in it's a very small area of London they're supposed to be in. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're living in slums because it's a bad neighborhood, all of that. The fact that none of them knew, especially Nick the Greek. Okay, Nick the Greek, literally, his job is to know everyone. Mm-hmm. He has a hand in every pie, okay? The fact that he didn't know that they were selling the weed to the person that owned the weed is the flaw. That's the hole in this movie. I mean, it's a gigantic hole to the size of that guy's afro. It's just huge. And Nick the Greek would have known, or one of the guys would have known. But you know, it can't happen if that mix up doesn't happen. And I think they sell it as like, oh, he's black, we don't hang out with him. And I think that's pretty much, or he's crazy, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, come on, guys, you know who the one big pot, like, high-level guy.
I'm going to defend that, because there's one thing that Nick the Greek didn't know, which was he knew that the guys were going to be taking it off of, these guys are going to be taking it from someone else. He didn't, because because even the boys didn't know exactly where the pot farm was. They only knew that the guys, that the next door neighbor was going to take pot from someone. So Nick the Greek might have thought that it might have been another grower. And there, more than likely, it's not just one grower.
Well, I mean, the house was the farmhouse. So, I mean, they were growing it in that place. Well, they weren't like growing
it. Mean
the black guy wasn't growing it and bringing it to them and then them. They were, he just owned them. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't own a pot farm somewhere. He owned them. They were the pot farm. So I don't know. I see what you're saying.
But yeah, that's the give me I'm going to give this movie when it comes to that.
Yeah, that's their give me. You have to give every movie one. It's like a time travel movie. You got to give them three.
But that brings me to my next question, though, because let's be honest here. There are so many threads going on in this movie. I mean, this could have been a 5 or 6 episode limited series.
Yeah,
at least
with all these parts moving around. Did you ever find yourself kind of having to remind yourself exactly who was what and who knew who? Did you ever find yourself kind of trying to keep up with a movie that was moving literally at breakneck speed?
I didn't. I really appreciated the fact that like everything was kind of interwoven, because it made the city or like the place that they're at, like that little corner, all together. Because it made me actually believe that Harry the Hatchet's there. And then you also have, and he's doing all of his whatever business, his sex shop, his everything, right? But then you also have Roy Breaker, who's doing the pot stuff, the drug stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have these other little guys that are on the streets, like Nick the Greek, that has kind of like he's a broker of everything, I guess is a good way to put it. And you have, it just made me feel like this whole little place is actually believable. It's not the whole town of London. It's just this little part of it,
this little neighborhood. The only thing that makes it even to go back to the thing about harder to believe that they didn't all know who everybody, what business everybody was in. And this is a problem because it was an indie. I mean, it was the budget of an indie movie, basically, is the problem that there were no people in the movie except for the people in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there was one cop.
The parking guy or the traffic cop.
I mean, but still, there's traffic cop, which I love him. He's a Welsh comedian. He's great.
Oh, he hosts
Would I Lie to You? It's a great game chat show on the UK. Check it out on YouTube. And you also have like there's three cab drivers that they send away by calling cabs. But it's like the original Punisher movie. The problem with that movie was there was no bystanders. So there are no bystanders in this movie other than the opening scene with Jason Statham. And that's just a flaw of budget. Like he couldn't control that. And I think if you had seen more people interacting with them, I mean, you don't even hear anybody talking at the pub when they're there, you know, the bartender's it, the bartender and the black, that's it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that would lead you to believe, oh, there were so many more people in this area that it would allow them to be mixed up. But what could he do? I mean, he made this movie so cheap, he couldn't stock it full of people like it should be. So,
right.
And London's like New York. They're on top of each other. So there would be lots of people. But it's fine. You know, you give me.
No, sure. All right. So let's talk about this plan. Again, I love the fact that there is a lot of moving pieces. I love the fact that even that things are semi, like you don't really have to think too hard about where everyone is. And you can kind of believe that you know people would have relationships with the people that they do. I can't believe that it took me forever to realize that the pot grower was financed and was basically working with
Breaker.
Sorry, I had a frame.
Okay,
a brain fart. That took me a while. I'm surprised that that didn't come to me sooner. But the plan itself is interesting in the sense that the four guys are going to be stealing from the robbers. Right, that's their deal. They're not going to go and try to beat them to this pot farm. They're going to wait until the guys steal from the pot farm, and then when they bring it back, they'll just grab them from there. That said, I also love the fact that they were stupid enough after getting the money and stealing from these guys to literally just take it right next door and count the money there.
Yeah, next door to the guys they robbed. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and that's, I think some people might have missed that in the movie, like people that don't follow fast-moving stories. Like a lot of times I'll leave a theater and I'll hear people going, did you understand what was happening? I was so confused. I'm like, it's so easy to understand, you know.
Right.
But there are some people don't track plot lines. Okay. Mm-hmm. Two of my kids are those people. I'm like pausing it. Do you understand what's going on? I don't want to call you stupid right now. So, you know, I think that people didn't realize they live next door to the people they robbed. So yes, they were morons for leaving the money there. You know, even though it was sheer luck that they burst the head through the wall and found the mic set up and all that.
Because they were going through, how would they know this? And they said they were going to be going to all the neighbors.
They also didn't recognize the voices of the four guys they lived next door to when they were robbed. So they shared a wall.
Yeah, that's a very thin wall. Like these aren't houses. These are like paper thin wall flats.
And they all hang out with gangsters, and they didn't recognize one of those guys' voices. So there wasn't a bright one in the bunch, really.
And that's why I think it's just like this little part of a bigger city.
Yeah, it's a neighborhood. Yeah.
Yeah, because everybody should know each other, but they're all, you know, screwing off and doing their own stuff all the time. And you see, like, I think you would see their face and be like, oh yeah, that's the guy that I gotta get now, because everything makes sense. But it's just so silly that they're literally right next door. I don't think I would have recognized their voice for sure, but I would recognize their face.
And I love the fact that, you know, after this whole heist is over, all the parts actually, it all is starting to converge on our four guys, because the pot growers go to Rory.
Yeah, Breaker. It's because he's not like Rory the Breaker.
I want to keep calling him Basher, and that's the problem. It's Breaker, but I think, you know, for some reason I have Basher in my head. Maybe that's Ocean's 11 there, because Don Cheadle is the best. But
man, way to connect two black guys there.
I'm sorry. I love Basher. I've always been a Basher fan.
Just messing with you. I just kept thinking Breakdancer to remember it, so I'm just as bad.
There you go.
All right, maybe.
But I think it is something where like all these other characters are like Boris the Blade from Snatch always stuck with me. Barry the Baptist stuck with me. Harry the Hatchet stuck with me on this one. But all the other characters, I don't care. Like, I don't know what their names are.
That's true. I mean, I Statham's character's name Bacon. I can't think of Bacon. I like Bacon, but I can't think of Statham as Bacon. I think of him as Statham. I mean,
and Vinny Jones. Vinny Jones is Vinny in every movie to me.
Yeah. And
you talked about how this movie could be like six episodes where like each episode focused on one thing. I would have loved that if they broke this down that way. And I would have watched like 3 years worth of Vinny and his son just robbing people. But
for sure,
but like Mutt and Jeff, where like the son is the boss and Vinny's just his heavy and the son just goes around like never ages. He's like, oh, you fuck you. I'm going to rob you. Okay, go get him. And it's like, all right. And he just robs him for the son. And the son's like smoking a cigar. Like, you need to do this quicker. You know, I could have watched that forever.
I think the dynamic's got to be there where Big Chris does like focus on his language the entire time, is beautiful, because if little Chris, you know, says a curse word, he's right there and be like, hey, figure out a better way. He can boss him around all the time. That's fine. Like
I wish that would have played in the finale. That was like when the car crash, I was hoping that the language would have come back on that.
I also think it would have been great if the kid had been the one that bashed his head in with the door. I thought that would have been so much better if he had hopped out first because Vinny Side was the one that was crashed.
Yeah.
So I think it would have been great if the guy tried to get out the Sun Side. The Sun's the one that did it. And Vinny had stood up there and just like looked approvingly at his son. I think that would have been like the cherry on top moment. Mm-hmm. Maybe it would have been too much for Guy Ritchie kid bashing it, but I thought it would have been in that kid's life. It wouldn't have been untrue to him.
So, right. I think that's something where you see that with Big Chris. And then once little Chris turns like 17 or like 16, when he's a little bit older, cause he's only like 12 in this movie at most.
Oh, max. Right. I'd say like, yeah, 9, 10.
Yeah. But I could see that like the final episode of that series, he takes over and just smashes someone with a door like that. That would be perfect. That'd be a kind of a good way to let it go.
Sadly, the final one is where he bashes his dad in. Come on, man. Mm. Get gritty.
Yeah, the dad curses and the son bashes him for that.
Yeah, Corey corrects him one last time. You corrected me.
Right.
Okay.
But the thing is, I appreciate that we're talking about stupid criminals. So they have the money next door. I love how as they're partying, we see all the forces that are against them, and then we're seeing them goof off and are like, I had a sense of dread for these guys. Like, oh man, they don't understand all the forces that are coming out to get them. And this is the moment where I realized how it's going to end, because I realized if you have all these forces that are going to come after these four guys, they're going to turn into a circular firing squad.
Right.
Yeah. And as soon as that thought came to me, it's like, as long as they don't go back in time, yeah, we're going to get the ending that we're going to get. And I have to admit, normally I would have been annoyed by being so right, except that Richie didn't just give me what I expected. He gave me what this movie needed.
Because, he gave you what you wanted, too. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Because it was fun. It was goofy. And I love the fact that we didn't actually see the massacre. You heard it. And you were outside of it, with the exception of the final two kills. And you don't even see that. You hear it, and then you see the outcome of that.
Although, I think if he had the budget, you would have seen it, and the movie would have been less than because of it.
Thank God.
And I think that I think that there's so many times where I said, I'm so thankful they did not have the budget.
Don't like, show the shark. Movies
like Highlander. These are like classics to me.
Yes.
That have this kind of feel to it. It has that dirty, gritty, grainy feel. That's a movie that I kind of see in the same line as Guy Ritchie's movies. If they had a budget, it would have been garbage. Like, you need movies to lack a little bit of the money. And the reason a movie bombs is usually because they've spent too much on things. They've shown you too much of the story. They've shown you too much. You need that like behind the door shootout, because you know how gory it is. It's perfect. You know exactly how gory it is. You don't need to see one bit of it, and your imagination has made it 10 times worse than what it could have been. But I bet if he had the budget then, being a young guy, because he was so young making that movie, he would have done everything. And it would have been like, all right, I mean, that's fine.
I don't know. I think he does such a good job kind of interweaving the violence and kind of the bloodiness.
And humor.
Because the pop-up of the girl that's just chilling out on the sofa while everything is happening.
And the one female in the movie.
Right, the one female in the movie, but that also just tries to shoot everybody.
I love how he shoots that machine gun shot, because that kind of stop frame thing where it shoots and then stops, shoots, stops, shoots, stops. And that has such a good look to it. Like, I was thinking to myself, how the fuck has this shot never been replicated before? This is awesome. I mean, it has.
I just can't remember. I mean, I don't think it's original to him. I just can't think of, I think it's like a Japanese
That probably, yeah, like a Yakuza movie.
Yeah, I really do. But I'm not going to say it is for sure. But I mean, I think that's something that calls back to there. But I agree with you. Nobody has done it as good as him, like at all. He perfected it with that shot. And the fact that she is nobody in this movie and all of a sudden just starts taking dudes out or at least hurting them. That was awesome, man.
We were introduced nobody to her saw it enough coming. To know why she's there, but just enough.
I mean, can we talk about how misogynistic this movie is? Because she's the only thing. No, I'm just kidding. There's a rom-com
guy. Do you really
want
more women in this movie? I mean, I feel like...
They'd just be dead.
Right.
I mean, we'll bring more women in, but they're going to die. It's like, whatever.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but we don't need any more refrigerators filled with things, you know? Just saying. Let's let the guys be cattle in this bloodbath. We'll slaughter them.
Although I'm betting Sting's wife is a badass. She's the one that got that bar. She like got it from Harry. It was a whole thing. That used to be Harry's girl. I'm writing the backstory for this movie. I got
Hold on. We're going to get to that. I promise you. We're going to talk about that because But no. Okay. So after that, I love not only that we have the circular firing squad in that apartment, but we also have the two guys that are looking for the guns that sold it to Nick the Greek, who sold it to the two guys who used it for the robbery. They found the guns at the shootout with Vinnie Jones, who's also there. You know, it all collides right there before the guys get there. Right?
Yeah.
And yeah, that was like, and so you think to yourself, okay, it could just end right here. You know, that these things will happen. They'll get the money or, you know, they'll come just in time. But no, Big Chris takes the money and, the guns to Harry. And I love the fact that Harry, even though he has the money, he has the guns, still is going to twist that knife in order to get that bar. Right. So he calls up and he basically tells him to come on over because basically we get the sense he's going to kill him, right? That it's gotten too far. He's gonna
or something.
And I love the fact that at this particular point, even though most of the players are dead by this point, we still have to deal with Harry. And why was I completely surprised when the two idiots just barge right on
are the ones that do it? That's great. It's great. Endless possibilities.
It might be my favorite part because it goes in like we see throughout the movie how bad that they are at everything, right? We see how dumb they are, how like definitely not proficient in any kind of things that they are. And you have Barry the Baptist that hires them thinking that he can just intimidate them into doing a good job. Well, he scares them enough to really like go through the whole thing. And then next thing you know, they're going after Harry the Hatchet, which is the one that started the whole thing, and everything just goes to shit. And seeing Barry the Baptist's face in there, where he realizes, oh, this is going to be bad. These dummies I've hired have now killed me. Like, yeah. It's fantastic.
Which spoke to my point of the dumbest criminals are the ones that went, oh, let's take out the biggest guy. Like I said, everything's possible to the dumbest among us. And so they were like, oh no, we could take out Harry the Hatchet, who rules this part of the city, who Sting thinks I could probably do it, but I'm not going to. Like, they decide they're going to do it and they do it. Yeah. It's great.
A couple of things I love. First off, I love that when they're going in, we see the sign that says Harry Porn King. Which, you know, it's a sex shop. We never got the idea that he was actually like making porn.
He killed a guy with the dildo.
Okay, that's something I feel like that would have been kind of cool if that would have come back, like he had the big black cock on his desk, and
right,
he takes out one of the guys with it. Although I will say that a close second is the hatchet being thrown. Yeah. Although Barry throwing the hatchet
instead of Harry the hatchet, I know
that was like maybe a missed opportunity. You know,
but what do you call a bad guy's flunky? Hatchet Man. You call him the Hatchet Man.
That's true.
That's what a bad guy's flunky is. So Harry the Hatchet is just the guy that tells you to use it. So when you think about it, I mean, that's what a Hatchet Man's been in every single movie. He's the flunky. So it kind of makes sense.
That's true. But I have to admit, the second thing I really love about it is that little thing between Barry and the perm guy. The fuck you doing here? The fuck are you doing here? As both of them are dying. I love that.
Well, why doesn't he still have that moon shape shot out of his hair? Because he got that moon shape shot out of his hair, and then he was just like wandering around like half wonky for a while. And I was like, they really should have like kept that heavy the whole movie.
Yes.
That was such a funny visual when they shot him and he had that like moon shape out of his head. I just giggled about it.
Yes.
It's funny. My perm.
And I just, yeah, I absolutely love the, I honestly love everything about it. I love how, you know, the one that got away from the Circular Firing Squad, you know, using Big Chris to get the money, and how Big Chris crashes the car into the three guys that are waiting to get the waiting for the money to waiting for their friend to come back, and again having the scene of him like you mentioned that it should have been the son doing that. There's one reason why I think I prefer it to be for Vinnie Jones, because let's be honest here, this is Vinnie Jones's big movie. Like this is a movie that pretty much guaranteed that he'll be able to play bad guys as long as he can still be tall and intimidating.
Well, he was literally in prison the day of filming.
Yes. Well, I mean, he's got a history. I mean, just Google Vinnie Jones. This guy, I am waiting for the Tyson-esque documentary about Vinnie Jones.
Yeah.
I mean, because you know it's coming. Someone is going to make that. Although I don't know if Vinnie Jones will be as eloquent as Mike Tyson.
Wow, who would have thought somebody would ever say that? I'm not sure he's going to be as eloquent as Tyson.
Well, just
there's the tagline for the movie. Wow. Fox Sock and Two Smoker Barrels. Vinny is not as eloquent as Tyson. Okay. There's also four barrels. I don't know if you knew that.
There you go. But the thing is that this movie, especially that scene, that cemented for me. Like, if that would have been the first time I saw Vinnie Jones instead of Gone in 60 Seconds.
I forgot that he was in there.
Yeah. that was a thing. But I saw him as the watered down henchman instead of this badass. Let's be honest. Big Chris is a badass. Right?
He doesn't actually have to do anything really in the movie because he intimidates everybody so much. I mean, yes. At the end of the film, he gets the money just by looking at the guy. He's like, all right, I've got two guns in my hand.
Sure. I wouldn't want to face Vinnie Jones either. Just saying. Parts of my anatomy will be dislodged.
But I think the fact that he is such a, like, in real world, such a bruiser, like, he was a big footballer and was just an aggressive little jerk on there. Mm-hmm. And it just came through this entire movie. And he's played more or less that same character throughout the rest of the movies that he's been in. And it works every single time. And he's pretty much the shining star of every single one. Yeah. Just because there's so much charisma coming out of him. Everything just hits. And you fully believe everything that he's saying. Like, I would never want to see Vinnie Jones in real life because I don't know if my life would be safe.
Yeah, sometimes you don't need range.
Yes.
Sometimes you just need to be really great at something.
And that is why he was able to be the lead in Name of the King for Uwe Boll. Just saying. That is a thing. But that said, though, I love that even when you think this movie is over, it's got one more thing it's got to say. And it, normally you could probably get to the point like, okay, just end it already. But it feels like it finds a way to make it worth it. So the cops come, they take the three boys away. They're still in the car, knocked out. They were innocent for the most part because they technically really didn't do anything with the exception of the robbery that they didn't have anything for, and all the evidence has disappeared. And so, they're able to get out of this. Although I also have a strange feeling that Sting had something to do with that. I don't know why. I feel like he his reach is a lot further than anyone is really giving credit for.
Right.
But
he leaned on Rob Brydon's character, the traffic guy. He was like, for sure. You ever want to come in my bar again alive? Yeah, definitely. Well, there's a whole backstory movie with Sting. Like, there's a whole, they could do like the whole movie where they've done this, they do it within movies before, mm-hmm. Sorry, let me say that again. They do that within movies now. I just watched the movie Anna, where she's a killer, and then they go 5 years ago, 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. Then they'll go back 5 years ago, 3 years ago, and show you what was happening in the next room. And then what was happening in the next room. There's a whole movie where Sting is in the next room lining all of this stuff up. He's like, oh, you know, that guy owns the weed, right? And they're like, oh, I didn't know that. And then he goes to the other guys. He goes, you know that you could put cameras in that boxing room. Yeah, sure. I don't know. You know, and he's like the one like making all of this happen because his ultimate goal is to get Harry. Like, he's put everything into place and he's just like polishing glasses and being like, I'm just Sting, man. Sting.
So when I go back and think about Lockstock, I don't have the same opinion of it as I do with Snatch, where I could watch a full series on Lockstock. Mm-hmm. I don't think I want to do that with Snatch. The only thing that I would want to do is really follow Vinnie Jones from movie to movie, his character, because it's the same when you go from Lockstock to Snatch. I would watch that. And like what Christian was saying, that like that father-son duo, mm-hmm. I would watch that for sure. But there's so much more, and I didn't realize that until I watched Lockstock again, that there's so many different forces on the outside. And everything that I liked with it comes to the gangsters is that they, like especially like Rory, he's out in a pub. But he's also like the head of all the drug trafficking in that area. Mm-hmm. Harry the Hatchet has such a visible presence. He's also running the whole town. And then it would have to be the same for Sting, where he can't be fucked with.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he has a certain set of skills that he's very good at.
Well, it's just like with Breaking Bad. You realize that Mike, the hired hitman, and the sleazy lawyer are the most interesting people to make a show about. And that's why you can make it with Vinny and with some of the other guys and be like, oh, this might have been better than the original thing that was made, because these two guys have so much, backstory and interest in them. It's really cool to think about.
Can we talk about the actual ending for a moment? Because I have to admit,
which one? The fourth ending?
The very final ending. Because they're going to get rid of the guns, because that's the only thing that's really tying them to the crime. But Vinnie Jones comes in with the bag. Because apparently we get the sense this thing basically told him, you bring the bag back. But he doesn't bring the money. But he brings them the catalog that shows the worth of the two guns.
They think there's some money in there, though.
I know.
He's like, I took my piece, and it's like, you took all of it.
Yes. But he left. But he left the thing about the guns, and that. And of course, we find ourselves. Have you all seen the original Italian Job? Out of curiosity.
No. I don't think, no.
Okay, if you get a chance, watch it. It's a lot of fun. But it ends with a problem that there's that is actually a challenge. This is a challenge that actually colleges get in on. That the ending of that, we actually talked about it on Art House Legends, but quickly, what it is that after they steal the gold in that movie, they're on a bus, and the bus finds its way or is crashes and is hanging off a cliff. And the guys are on one end, the gold is on the other. And if any of them move, the bus is going to fall. And at the end of the movie, Michael Caine says, "Hold on, I got a plan," which is it's the tagline of the movie, basically. But it ends there, so we don't know if they ever get the gold. But it leaves us with that conundrum. We have kind of the same situation here, right? The guns are on the ledge. He has the phone in his mouth. His Bacon's calling him to let him know, but it's in his mouth. He's reaching out for the guns. Does he flip the guns? Does he grab the guns? What is going to happen in this moment?
And Schrodinger's cat. Either way, it's dead.
Yeah.
Either way.
Yeah.
It's dead. You open the box, he's dead. You don't open the box, he's dead.
You know what this reminds me of? Did any of you see Trainspotting 2?
No.
Which...
I haven't heard that.
Trainspotting 2 takes place 20 years after the events of the first Trainspotting. So you actually find out what happens to everyone in that interim.
Gotcha.
And so, and it's not a good movie. It's one of those, like, if you really enjoyed it, and I really didn't, I mean, I can't feel like anyone actually enjoys Trainspotting. The movie's just too brutal. But if you are curious about where it goes from there, I found myself asking myself, wouldn't it be interesting to see where these guys are now 20 years later? We are now 20 years after Lockstock. So what would have happened to these guys? You know, what, you know, would Sting still have the bar? Would he be the new Harry? Because, you know, power vacuums and stuff like that?
Maybe, yeah.
I mean, yeah. Would these guys still be, like, you know, scrambling for small-time hustles? Would they have gotten their big hit? What would happen?
I thought, you know, the ending of the movie where he walks up to him with the bag and he goes, you know, you got Harry and all that. And he says earlier in the – they say earlier in the movie, it might have been the voiceover, that – now, I think he told Harry, he goes, oh, I just recognize that when you get the opportunity, you take this opportunity. Mm-hmm. That's what he said, because he's a very basic guy. He's I work for you. I do A and B. I always stick to my word. They never think about him double-crossing anybody. Big Chris is, you know, 100% his word. I thought it would have been great if he had said, I'm the type of guy that works for people. Mm-hmm. So I took my piece. He leaves them a piece. And they become Harry. And I thought that, you know, I mean, when I saw it the very first time, mm-hmm. I was like, oh my gosh, did he recognize in himself, I'm a worker bee. I'm the best worker bee. I need a head to work for. And then he gives them the money and that starts them becoming, you know, the new Harry. Because he's like, well, you took out the boss. I need a boss. I thought that would have been great. That would have been my way of ending the movie and then leaving it open for that second movie, which he never thought he was going to have a second movie. I mean, he's, you know, this was his big, you know, debut. So,
yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Watching the ending of this movie always makes me smile because I work with cell phones all day, every day. And that feel of A, not knowing anybody's phone number, but B, like it's such a basic cell phone. And then seeing that, I can't imagine anybody that sees this movie that's been born in the last 20 years know what anything that they were holding. Because you have the pull-out antennas, you have the Nokias, you have these bricks, but just to see it in his mouth, that would hurt so much when it actually rang because it's so loud. And even if it's vibrating, it's going to crack his teeth. So I think he screwed either way.
I like the idea of him somehow falling in the river with the guns.
I like the idea of the guns in the water too. And their new thing is like, I've got a plan to get them out. And then it's just another, they're right. constantly running plans and somebody else gets them. A fish trawler gets it. They find out it's the big crooked fish guy from Ireland. They have to go over there and deal with him. He's Harry the fisherman. And it's a whole thing. Like he's like, he uses a hook instead of a hatchet. Harry the hook. Harry the hook. Yeah. It's just crazy. And then,
but I usually, that's funny. I usually hate cliffhangers. Like I kind of want an actual ending that you can see, but it works for me. I really like the ending.
I do too. And the thing is that even though technically it's a cliffhanger or, you know, bridge hanger, I guess you could say, honestly, the thing is the prize was never the money. The prize was their lives. And the movie over and over and over again keeps reminding us, these guys are dead if they don't fix this. Them being able to get more money out of that is being greedy. So if the guns went into the river...
But they're still down their 100 grand. They each put in 25.
But they're still alive.
They didn't I know, but they didn't even get to come out even.
Right.
You know, they're going after those guns. It doesn't matter what happens to them. Well, they're going after those guns.
Yes, true. But the thing is, though, is that the film itself sets the prize as their lives. They get to breathe after this is over. 100K short, if the guns go. If they don't, then they'll get a couple. They'll be able to eke out a little bit of money. It won't be the $500,000 that cash was going to give them. But so that's the resolution that the film needed. The guns is kind of an afterthought. It's kind of that little kiss on the cheek, you know, just having a little bit of fun after you get it, the after dinner dessert, if you want to say it. So to me, that's perfectly fine. I feel like it's not really a cliffhanger in the sense that anything from the film itself has actually not been addressed, if that makes sense.
Yeah. But that last shot, like if you put just like a laughing track and like a goofy song, that would have been a sitcom in the 90s. Like that last final scene where he's hanging on the bridge. He's got the phone in his mouth. And that if you would have just had that kind of like goofiness to it, I could see that as like the end of a whole series of terrible sitcoms, and it would have been great.
Yeah,
whole bunch of terrible sitcoms, and that would have been great. Now mm-hmm. That's a tagline for the movie. All right, so is there anything else that you think we haven't touched on when it comes to this movie? Or are we ready for Geek Sheet?
Sure.
All right, so the Geek Sheet, for anybody who's joining the show for the first time, is an opportunity for us to look at the filmmaker, the people who are in the film or that have associations with the film, and the geeky stuff that they've done either before or after. These are science fiction, action, things that you might have already known about these people have done before. Obviously, since we're talking about Guy Ritchie, he did the Aladdin remake 2 years ago, right? It wasn't even last year. It was 2 years ago. Or was it last year?
It was last year.
My goodness. It feels last so year, long
I think.
Ago.
This, I think so.
This whole 4 months feels like a year. So I don't know what time is anymore.
That's true. Yeah. That is true.
I think it was last spring.
And he's done Sherlock Holmes. He did that really bad King Arthur movie. I'll be honest here. I'm not a Charlie Hunnam fan. So. Anytime that he's leading a
man,
it took a lot for me to really enjoy The Gentleman because he was so prominent in it.
He's really, really good in Green Street Hooligans, though. Let me tell you,
I love Green Street Hooligans. But the thing is, he has a British accent in that, and I don't know. Maybe it's just when he has an American accent that just kind of. Doesn't do it for. But, I'm sorry, Sons of Anarchy. That I was the only person that was waiting for Jax to die from the first episode. So I love the rest of the show. I hated Jax, but you know, the Guy Ritchie and Matthew Vaughn were they were a partnership for the first few movies, until Matthew Vaughn decided to start directing his own movies. But now we can only say that Matthew Vaughn is maybe even a better filmmaker than Guy Ritchie, to an extent, or at least he has taken some very interesting projects, and done a whole lot more with it than Guy Ritchie has. Can we agree on that part?
I mean, I think he's been given bigger opportunities, but
yeah,
you know, I think if Guy Ritchie had directed some of the movies Vaughn did, it would have been just as good. I mean, nobody sees, he did the Kingsman movies, right?
Yeah.
So nobody sees the Kingsman movies and doesn't say, oh, that's like a Guy Ritchie movie. Like, it's impossible to. So,
right.
You know, I think that Guy Ritchie could have made the Kingsman. Definitely.
Yeah. And Vaughn's got like a weird director credits, I guess. I mean, you got Layer Cake, which I really, really like. But then you also have X-Men First Class and Kick-Ass in there. And then you go into all the Kingsman movies. So it's such a varied thing. Yeah, and
I like all those movies you talked about.
Yeah, but it's like, such
I thought
a
that
varied,
was a great reboot and everything. Yeah.
It's such a like a varied way of doing everything, though. And when you look at like a Guy Ritchie film, only I feel like recently has he strayed away from his original stuff.
I think some guys don't want to take other people's IPs, though. So, and I think Vaughn's willing to take another IP and go, yeah, I'll direct that. Sure, yeah, I like that. He's also a comic book nerd, so that has a lot to do with it.
But out of curiosity, have either of you watched Stardust?
The, mm-hmm.
Michelle Pfeiffer?
Yeah. With Michelle Pfeiffer and...
on a treadmill in the gym, if Robert that counts.
Yes, I... because I
was like, I don't like this.
Oh, you didn't like Stardust?
Well, I mean, it's also on a treadmill in the gym, so that right. might have something
fair
to do
enough. Fair enough. Fair enough. I don't watch movies on the treadmill. That's a good way to hate a movie. But but no, I mean, Matthew Vaughn has done incredible stuff, and I love the fact that he does a lot. And I have a feeling we'll be getting to one of his movies, probably Kick-Ass, at some particular point. But yeah, so. I find it fascinating that he came up with Guy Ritchie doing these movies. Jason Statham, we talked pretty much in extension. I'm glad that we have been talking about Fast and Furious throughout the podcast. I feel like that's what everyone goes straight to is Fast and Furious when it comes to him.
I'm not about it.
Those aren't geek movies. Those are bro movies. That's a fraternity movie.
I'm sorry.
I mean, I'll watch them, but they're bro movies.
Okay,
Transporter.
I have a love hate relationship. I wrote an essay on my love hate relationship on the Fast and Furious movies.
I don't know how to feel about that.
The depth of depression that some people will sink.
Yes.
I can't explain it, but you've been there.
Yes.
And I applaud you for coming out of it.
I mean, is writing an essay even allowed when we talk about Fast and Furious? Because
he was like, essay! essay! I want to talk about Fast and Furious. That's
essay
allowed.
And Familia? Is that what it is?
Okay, all right. I'm regretting even bringing that up.
Bringing that up.
Dexter Fletcher,
awesome.
You talked about him. The reason why I know him is because he made a movie last year that really surprised the hell out of me how much I loved it, which was Rocket Man. He directed that, and I don't know if either one of you seen Rocket Man, but
the Elton John movie.
Yeah, the Elton right? John.
Yeah, the one that was better than the Queen movie, but because Queen had won everything and was garbage, they didn't nominate the Elton John movie, which everybody said was way better in every way.
And Taron Egerton, he should have been nominated. I'm sorry, he should have been nominated.
Yeah, well, he sang. Like
they didn't win because of Queen. I mean, the previous year.
Yeah.
That's the only reason. And Queen was a worse movie and won editing, which everybody go to YouTube and it's super cool.
That's so funny.
And just Google it on YouTube. Anyway, it's garbage. But Rocket Man was a far superior movie, but they're like, we've done this already. We got to move on to a different style of movie.
Yeah.
Yes.
Get screwed.
Yeah, but Dexter Fletcher directed it and Matthew Vaughn produced it. So there you go.
And I think Fletcher's been in a lot of geeky stuff. I feel like, I don't have his IMDb in front of me. You might, but I feel like he was in like some Deep Space Nines or something like it. I feel like he was in some of those movies.
He may have been in Stargate.
I don't think he was in Stargate. He might have been, but I feel like he was in some of those, and he's like, he's done the episode of the week thing on some stuff, and especially watching more British TV. Mm-hmm. I've seen him pop in and out of stuff. So he's awesome.
Oh, he's trust me, our audience will be more than happy to remind us of every Star Trek, Stargate, Star Wars, and anything with the word Star.
I'm thinking Deep Space Nine, but for some reason, it's something like that, where he definitely was in one of those, or Andromeda or something like that. Yeah.
All right, so I feel like we talked about Vinnie Jones and Sting quite a bit, going through their geekiness. All right, so let's go ahead and let's break this down. All right, so how we do things is that I'm going to ask you a simple question. The simple question is: do you agree with the critics on Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels? If you believe that they were right and that this film has deserved the honor and acclaim that this movie has gotten, the legacy, you will pass it. If you believe that this does not deserve that, that it is overrated, that it is absolute garbage, you will fail it. Or if you can kind of agree with the critics but not really go there with them, you can go the easy way and say maybe. So, gentlemen, starting with Christian, do you agree with the critics?
Pass. You don't have to ask it. It's pass. Usually you'd say hard pass, which means I don't like it, but with your rating system, pass is good, so hard pass.
There you go.
I mean, come on, you can't say anything other than that.
Any final words on the movie before moving on? All right.
Me? No. No, it's a great film. It's a great film. I could watch 30. I've already said I'm willing to watch 30 versions of this movie. How am I not willing to watch? I mean, I think it would definitely have better sequels than Star Wars. And I have that movie in my blood. So yeah, I would watch all of the lock stocking 20 barrels. I don't care. You can't count barrel. I don't care. Just give them all to me.
Yeah, just as long as they do them in doubles. So, like, Lock, Stock, and Four Smoking Barrels, Lock, Stock, and 8 Smoking Barrels. Not just you add two more. You have
Lock, Stock, we added 2 Smoking Broads. Yeah, whatever.
No, you have to use exponents. So it would be 2, 4, 16.
Sure.
Whatever. We would watch it. I think that's the point. We would watch
Lock, Stock, and 60 sequels. I don't care. I'm watching it.
There you go. All right, Chris.
It's a hard pass for me too. It's a very, not only is it like a good movie, but it's also a very important movie because it kicked off such big style and flair and a way of filmmaking that has resonated for the past 20 years. You look at stuff like what Matthew Vaughn does, you look at all the different action and cuts and all the different ways to actually film stuff and the use of music, which we didn't talk about at all. The use of music, I think, started really with Guy Ritchie as far as making it stylized and artful and really blending in the different pieces with the energy of the music. I think that right there makes it a pass for me all the way through.
And I'll be honest, I ask myself this when it comes to Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, now that I've seen it. If I would have seen it when it originally came out, just before The Matrix, and understand that I consider 1999 to be one of the best film years of all time. We had so many great movies that came out in 1999. If I had seen Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels when it came out just before The Matrix, would that have changed my excitement for that year? Because I feel like at the beginning of the year, it was just to patterings, right? Just little droplets here. You had Matrix, and then you had The Mummy remake, which I will go to the mat on anyone who says otherwise. It is a great fucking movie.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness.
Wait, what movie?
The Mummy remake.
The Brendan Fraser one?
Brendan Fraser, absolutely. I will cut a bitch.
I mean, going to the mat's hard. I do like it better now, but I left the theater going, why did they keep screwing up Indiana Jones? But that's okay. Whatever.
Let me just put it this way. I didn't go to prom to go to the Mummy. That's how much I loved it.
This is a story you don't need to explain. You said, I'll go to the mat for the Mummy. We all knew about prom. Nobody questioned your prom after you said that. Nobody thought you knew what prom was. The moment you said, I'll go to the mat for Brendan Fraser's Mummy, people were like, well, he didn't get laid at prom.
Right.
Oh, if only you knew. All right. So, but the thing is that, honestly, this is a great movie. I really enjoyed it. Is it predictable? Absolutely. And I feel like 18-year-old me would have probably rolled my eyes at how predictable it was. But then I would be kicking my 18-year-old ass for feeling that way. But
18-year-old, you like the Mummy, so.
Yes. Yes. But, I will go to the bat for it. All right. You want to come for that episode? Feel free. We'll do it this summer. Anyway, but seriously, honestly, I really enjoyed this movie. It's going to be one of those that I'm going to regret not seeing it in theaters. I'm going to regret, having waited this long to see this. Because this is, while I still think that Rock and Rolla is still slightly better, The Gentleman maybe slightly better, this is still good. This is damn good. This is a lot of fun. I could watch this over and over again, hopefully with a better HD remaster because the DVD is shit. I really enjoy this. Gentlemen, thank you so much for coming and joining me for this conversation. I hope everyone had a blast. At this time, Christian, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me all over the internet. You can find my podcast right now, daddoesromcoms.com, and everywhere podcasts are found. If you're interested in seeing a dad fail at sewing, I actually sew live on camera at dadsews.com. That is a big thing for me. It's great. Look me up on YouTube on Dad Sews. And then I've had various other podcasts, which you can find me at plaiddadblog.com because I'm the internet's dad. So I'm there for you. If you need a shoulder to cry on or you need a smack, that's me. I'm your dad.
Chris.
You can find me at Ambition Radio. That's my podcast where I interview people who have found some kind of balance between their life, family, career, and the pursuit of their passions, dreams, or hobbies. So Christian, you and I might need to talk.
Yeah, I think that's something I wanted to do immediately when you
did. So you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, email me at ambitionradiopodcast@gmail.com. Let's talk. I'm trying to do during this quarantine is record episodes, hate my voice while I edit episodes, and then post episodes.
I don't envy the edit on this episode.
It's terrible.
And if you're wanting to get more Art House Legends goodness, you can definitely do so by going on to all of your favorite podcast choices, iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, we're everywhere. You can go on to our archive at arthouselegends.libsyn.com. If you want to get a hold of us, we're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, at Art House Legends. We're on, I think we're on Instagram. If not, I'll be on Instagram at some point. We're on YouTube. We have ears everywhere. And if you just want to just give us a nice little email letting us know how awesome we are or to share recipes in this apocalypse, you could do so at arthouselegends@gmail.com. And I'll get straight back to you as soon as possible.
Gentlemen, one more thing. Sorry. I hope I'm not messing you up. You can cut it if you want to, okay. But on my Instagram at Dad Does Romcoms, I'm going to do what we normally do for our romcoms. And I'm going to throw up all of the tropes when you release this episode for the trope shot drinking game. So you can check that out because there are too many. I want to do that. And all of my alternate titles that I've got for this movie which of course included Unlocked Gate and Four Smoking Idiots, because it's genius. Pat myself on the back for that. But yeah, like I'm going to throw those up too. So come find me on Instagram, because I want to hear your listeners' alternate titles for this movie. And I want to see if anybody actually plays a trope drinking game, because I would love to hear how smashed they get with multiple montages in this movie. So definitely.
Absolutely. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me for this episode. This is the Movie Dude, Eric.
This is Chris Sondable.
This is Christian Lee.
And Fiend.